Chapter 4 this morning, Ecclesiastes chapter 4, and as you're turning there, let me just say a special thank you from Rebecca and I to the church and all those who helped with the pastor recognition last Sunday. It is definitely a joy and a privilege to serve alongside you here. We're very thankful, very blessed by your care and your appreciation for us, and just want to say thank you personally for that. I know Lynn and Carol and Krista and anyone else that helped with getting everything set up for the reception, as well as the elders getting things organized, and just very special to us. Not one that will show feelings a whole lot, but it does. We are very, very grateful for that and very thankful for your care and prayers for us. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, now I get to throw the hammer down, right? This is soften it up, buttered everything up, and no. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, if you're visiting with us this morning, we've been working our way through Ecclesiastes. We find ourselves this morning in chapter 4. We're going a little slower, and I'll touch on that here briefly, but we are going a little slower than we have up to this point. But this morning we do continue our way through Solomon's observation of life in this fallen world. So if you're there in chapter 4, let's pick up with verse 4 and we'll read verses 4 through 6. Solomon writes, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh, and better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after wind." As I mentioned, these are Solomon's observations of life in this fallen world in which we live. They are tragic and they are sad observations about the way in which man conducts his life here upon the earth, as he does so in an effort to try to find satisfaction, as he does so in an effort to try to find happiness and meaning in life. This is what he gives himself over to. And at the end of chapter 3, verses 16 through 22, we see that Solomon observed wickedness in the place of justice and righteousness. Where there is supposed to be fairness and justice, he says there's bias, there's injustice. Where judgments and laws are to be passed that promote righteousness or moral behavior, they instead condone and promote wickedness. And he concludes that this happens, it's this way, that there's wickedness in these places, because man gives little consideration to what happens to him after he dies. If I don't know what happens to me after I die, why not just live however I want to live and do whatever I can to get life to go in my favor? Pass laws, have no law, whatever it may be. That was really his first observation, injustice in the place of justice. The second one we looked at last week in verses 1 through 3, where he recalls for us his observation of all the acts of oppression that he witnessed under the sun. And this led him to conclude that people are so consumed with their own self-interest that they will domineer over others in order to get what they want in life. And then there are others who are so consumed with their own self-interest in pursuits of pleasure and happiness that they give really little consideration to those who are oppressed, so focused on their own life. And he said, sadly, even those who suffer oppression, he says, rarely will they call out to God in those situations to deliver them because of the wickedness and the pride of their own hearts. So we continue our study through this chapter this morning, and hopefully we will conclude this chapter next Sunday. We also see that Solomon observed in verses 4 through 6, the one we'll focus on this morning, the envy man has toward his neighbor. In 7 through 12, he observed the one who is self-seeking in his pursuits, the one who basically just lives completely for himself. He gives himself to everything under the sun, even though he has really no one to even leave it to. In verses 13 through 16, as we conclude it, we'll look at the leader who takes no advice, and the leader who is quickly forgotten. As I mentioned, we are going through this chapter a little slower than we have the previous ones, and that's intentional. Because each of these observations that Solomon points out to us here, they really stand alone. They're not really a continual thought. So I think it's important that we give adequate attention to each one of them. As I mentioned last week, if you remember, these observations that we see here serve as reminders to us that this world is not what God intended it to be. It is not what He intended it to be when He created it. And for sure, mankind does not act the way that he intended for them to act when he created us. You have wickedness instead of justice. You have bias instead of fairness. You have oppression instead of kindness. You have negligence instead of concern. You have pride instead of humility. And those were all the things that we just saw in the first two observations. And so these observations are given to us by Solomon to remind us of the harsh realities of living in this fallen world. Any hope of creating your own paradise in this world apart from God is futile and pointless because of all of these outside factors. And they also remind us of the harsh reality of the various ways man interacts with one another, far from being what they should. This is how man interacts with one another, seeking his own pleasure and his own happiness. But beyond just simple reminders to us of what life is like and reminding us of how man interacts with one another, they are also given to us by Solomon because they're like flashing red lights. He's saying, warning, warning, warning. If you go down this road and you look to these things to provide you satisfaction and happiness in life, you are going to be gravely disappointed. If you try to find or create an environment where we will believe we will find satisfaction and happiness in life apart from God, I'm warning you, don't go down this path. If you're pursuing these things for happiness and satisfaction, you are going to be disappointed. For example, many assume, maybe even some of us, that a world full of justice and morality would allow us to be happy and satisfied in life. I would like that. I would like the world to be full of justice and full of morality. And so people fight for justice, they fight for morality, and they want those who violate justice to be properly dealt with, and so on. We want that. We think that would be a wonderful thing. And in fact, that type of environment would be beneficial to us. And Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan. We would want that. But the harsh reality is that we will always contend with those who don't want justice and morality. Even at times being ruled by those who don't want such things. And sometimes the scale tips in the favor of those who want justice and morality, but sometimes the scale tips in the favor of those who don't want such things. And so Solomon is saying, listen, if you're looking to a world full of justice and morality to bring you happiness and satisfaction, you're going to be disappointed because there's always going to be those who don't want those things. And you're always going to be contending with them. You're on a futile and meaningless pursuit because of that. Even those who don't want justice and morality have to contend with those of us who do. So those who want to find satisfaction and happiness in life with a world full of injustices and full of immorality, they got to contend with those who want such things. And so their satisfactions are never fully met either. And many assume that one can find satisfaction and happiness in life if we lived in a world where we never had to face oppression. That would be a wonderful thing to behold. And so measures are taken and promoted that man believes will create a world in which that will be the case. It'd be a good thing. The reality is that we don't live in such a world. The sinfulness of man leads him to dominate over others in an effort to always get what he wants in his life. In this world, as we saw last week, there are those who oppress, there are those who suffer oppression, and there are always those who are consumed with their own self-interest and pursuits that they even give no comfort to those who are oppressed. So Solomon is warning us by giving us this observation. Listen, this is a red flag. Warning, watch out. If you are looking to a world and your hopes and satisfactions lie and reside in a world free from oppression, you're going to be gravely disappointed. You don't have enough power to stop all those who oppress others. You can't protect all of the powerless who fall victim to oppression. And you can't provide comfort to every victim of oppression. Because even if you could, there will be those who don't want your comfort. A sad reality. Now, let me be very clear. It's not wrong to want and pursue measures that promote justice and morality and freedom from oppression. Each of these things are good and biblical things to desire. So Solomon is not saying you shouldn't want these things. Solomon's warning to us is, however, that if we are looking to these things alone for satisfaction and happiness in life, we're on a futile pursuit. It's like chasing after the wind, because the evilness of man will always keep these things at an arm's reach. You'll never be able to attain them. Now, I understand that you may not be tempted, to find happiness and satisfaction in life through justice and morality or freedom from oppression as others might be. I mean, we would like them. I would like them to reign in society. You would like them to reign in society. You know the important role they play in the well-being of a society. We know how beneficial they are when justice is being carried out, when morality is being practiced, when there is no oppression. And they would bring us joy and satisfaction in life if that was the dominant thing being practiced in any culture. But I understand they probably don't tug on your heart. Is it to say, that's where all my happiness, that's where all my satisfaction lies? I realize that. Those of us who are in Christ, who understand truth, we know that that's not where our satisfaction and happiness lie. However, Solomon's next observation about life under the sun is a temptation I believe all of us face, even probably struggle with from time to time, maybe many times to many times. A temptation that does pull at our heart and our emotions, deceiving us into thinking that satisfaction and happiness in life maybe can be found in these things. And that temptation being the envy of our neighbor. Envying what others have and seeking to not only have what they have, but if possible, to have something better. I do believe that temptation does pull at our hearts. So this will be observation number three that we come to this morning. Observation one would have been just injustice in the places of justice. Observation two last week would have been oppression in this world. This morning, observation number three, the rivalry of envy in verses 4-6. If you're taking notes on the back of your bulletin, there is an outline that will at least help you follow along some. I know there's not a lot of room there to write notes, but it will at least allow you to follow along a little better. Observation number three this morning, the rivalry of envy. Solomon says here in verse 4, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor." Growing up, I often heard, as I'm sure you probably often did as well, that when you witnessed such family doing such and such, you said, they're just trying to keep up with the Joneses. How many of you have heard that, right? You've heard that phrase as well. And that phrase is used to describe someone who is trying to maintain the same social status as some other family in town. That is, more than likely, trying to do the same thing. They're trying to maintain the same social status as some other family in town. People buy a new car because this family bought a new car. People buy a bigger house because this family bought a bigger house. The lengths that people will go to in order to outdo one another are endless and very many. But growing up, I never had to worry about that dilemma. I never had to worry about this dilemma of trying to keep up with the Joneses by trying to outdo someone else or try to outdo something else that they had done. One, we weren't the Joneses. We weren't the family that was the Joneses. So no one was trying to keep up with us. And number two, we didn't have the means to keep up with the Joneses. So there was no way that we were going to try to be in this competing back and forth trying to outdo someone else. And so that back and forth of trying to outdo one another was not something that I had to deal with and struggle with, or that my family even had the means to do. However, though our family did not have the means to wage this kind of social status rivalry between some other family or some other individual, my heart still envied what they had. I wanted to be in that rivalry. I wanted to be in that battle. If I couldn't be the Joneses, I at least wanted to be the family that competed with them. My heart longed for the world's goods, thinking that that was where my happiness was going to lie, that that was where satisfaction in life was to be found. Being better than my neighbor, for sure. But if I couldn't be better, at least I would be like them. And that would be a joyful place to be. That rivalry, even if it's just within our own hearts, and this desire for wanting what others have, regardless of what that may be, whether it's fame, skills, possessions, money, health, career, even wanting our spouse or our children to be like that of someone else, are all ways in which we envy our neighbor. And this rivalry and this desire for wanting what others have is an age-old issue that has plagued all of mankind. And it is even an issue that we still struggle with as Christians and in the church. In Genesis chapter 4, for example, Cain wanted the attention that Abel received from God. He envied Abel. In Genesis chapter 37, Joseph's brothers hated him because of the love he received from their father. And Acts chapter 7, verse 9 tells us that that they were so driven by envy that they sold him into slavery. In Exodus 20, verse 17, when God gave Israel the Ten Commandments, he explicitly commanded them not to covet anything that belonged to their neighbors. In 1 Samuel 18, Saul was jealous and envious of the praise and wisdom that David received. In Matthew 27, 18, maybe the worst case of envy ever, the Jews, out of envy, chose Barabbas over the Lord Jesus Christ. And throughout Paul's ministry, he again and again had to defend his own ministry from the attacks of false teachers and others who were jealous of his ministry. There's even a major issue within the 12 tribes that James writes to in James chapter 4, verses 1 and 3, and we'll look at that here in a minute. It's a major issue, always has been, always will be. And Solomon here is flashing the red lights at us again. He's warning us that if you think you'll have satisfaction, if you think you'll have happiness in this life and having more than your neighbor, he says at the end of verse 4, that this too is vanity, that this too is a striving after the wind. So as we take a deeper look at Solomon's observations here in verses 4 through 6, we're going to come away with four objective truths regarding envy. Four objective truths regarding envy. Number one, the root of envy. That is, why does man envy his neighbor in the first place? What's going on there? Number two, the fuel for envy. What empowers us to envy our neighbor? What allows us to acquire what our neighbors have and want? Number three, the emptiness of envy. What does it really accomplish anyways? Number four, the alternatives to envy. If we're not supposed to envy our neighbor, then what can we do? As we look at each of these, it's my prayer that the Spirit of God will reveal to us this morning the envy that's in our own hearts, and that He will reveal to us the wisdom of God in dealing with it. So number one, the root of envy. Why do we envy our neighbors? Why is it that we want what they have so bad? Why is it that we want to be better than them? Whatever that may be. Why do we want their wealth? Why do we want their fame? Why do we want their possessions? Why do we want their friends? Why do we want what others have as far as a career? Maybe good health, a loving spouse, obedient children, maybe their talents, their gifts. Why do we want what they have to offer so badly? In order for us to understand the reason behind our envy, we need to understand what envy is in the first place. The word that Solomon uses here in the middle of verse 4, man's envy of his neighbor, speaks of rivalry and jealousy. But it's very passionate. It's very emotional. It drives you to want more. It drives you to be bitter. It drives you to be zealous and angry or even displeasured with what you don't have in comparison to someone else. We want the same things others want, and we want to be superior over others in that pursuit. We're okay if they get something, that's fine, but as long as we get the same thing, or if not, get something a little better. It's what drives us. And envy throughout the New Testament is seen as a feeling, a passion of displeasure that is produced when we witness or that we hear of the advantage and prosperity of others. Look at the words of James in James chapter 4 for just a minute. Turn to James chapter 4. James really expounds for us what Solomon talks of here in verse 4. James chapter 4. He says, beginning of verse 1, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. The root of envy is the sinful passions of our own hearts. The passions that James says here war within us, they're always battling. They never allow our hearts to rest. We were never able to rest with contentment and peace. They're always stirring us up. They're always pushing us to want more. They battle within us. He says these passions cause us to desire what we don't have. These passions cause us to covet what is not ours. And even when we do ask for such things, these passions really cause us to be manipulative. We ask, which is much better than fighting and quarreling, but our motives are not pure, James says. We simply want to satisfy the sinful pleasures and passions of our heart. We feel like asking would be the least form of resistance. And the psalmist says, this is it. This is what drives us. This is what is at the root of envy, is this passions of sin that wage war within us. The passions is a heart that is not content or grateful with what God has given us. We're not happy with what He's dealt us. We're not trusting His control over our lives. And so we strive to acquire for ourselves what we believe we deserve and what we believe we must have. And if we don't obtain it, we, like Cain, feel as if God has cheated us, and that we deserve something better. And I understand none of us would ever say that. Those words would never come out of our lips saying, God actually cheated me. But I can assure you the battle being raged in our heart says, yeah, I think maybe He has. We see the good that befalls others, and we wonder why that didn't happen to us, or why doesn't that happen to us. We see the struggles that come into our lives and not into the lives of others, and we wonder, what did I do to deserve this? Why hasn't God delivered me from these things? Why hasn't God orchestrated the events of my life that would protect me from such things? Don't I serve God better than that person? Shouldn't I be getting what that person's getting and not them? These are all ways in which we fight with envy. Our fight with envy manifests itself in our thinking. We constantly compare our lives and what we have to those around us. We understand that the root of envy is our discontent. We're not happy. We're not grateful for what God has done. We have displeasure about what has been bestowed upon us. And in essence, we distrust what God is doing, and we distrust God providing for us. This is the root of envy. These passions wage war within our soul. They cause us to want what we don't have. They covet what cause us to covet what is not ours. And they ask for things only to satisfy our sinful pleasures. That's the root of envy. Not happy, displeasure, discontent, not trusting. We want what is not ours. This wage, this battle, these sinful desires that wage war within our souls. Number two, the fuel for envy. What empowers us to envy our neighbor? Understand, there's a lot of things that feed our envy. Complaining feeds our envy. As we complain about the things that we don't have, that's a manifestation of our envy, and that just feeds our envy, because the more we complain about it, the more we think that we deserve it, the more we think that we need it. Lusting obviously feeds our envy, as we lust after things that aren't permitted to us and belong to someone else. Fantasizing, daydreaming, oh, life would be so wonderful if I had that. Life would be so wonderful if that happened to my life. That feeds our envy as we think about what life would be if we have everything that we wanted. Obviously, these things feed our envy. But what is it that allows us to acquire our pleasures that are driven by envy? In other words, what is it that fuels this rivalry between our neighbors? What allows us to kind of go between this back and forth between comparing ourselves to others? What is it that allows us to buy that bigger house or that nicer car? What is it that allows us to be better at something than another so that we can display before others that we are better than them? What is it that allows us to wage this rivalry with our neighbor, our fellow man, this back and forth? Well, Solomon tells us here at the beginning of verse 4. He says, then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. And Solomon explains to us that man, in his fallenness, man in his desire to acquire more and to be better than his neighbor, he's learned that to win in this rivalry of envy, he's got to be better at them, or he's got to outwork them. It tells us that often the motivation behind one's hard work, the motivation behind someone's skill and success, is man's desire to have more and man's desire to be better than his fellow man. We've learned that if we want what others have and if we want to be better than others, then hard work and skill will often accomplish that for us. That's what drives us. Realize the American dream was well and alive in the hearts of men long before America was ever established. And that if you work hard and you apply yourself, then the sky is the limit for you. That's what drives our culture. That's what drives people. And Solomon says that mentality has been the driving force fueling man's envy since the fall of man. If I'm going to get better than them, I just got to work harder. If I'm going to be better than them and acquire more than them, I just have to have more skill than they do. And that's sad. There's a sad reality behind both of those things. Hard work and skill, those are not only respectable attributes, but those are commendable in the sight of God. Both hard work and skill are pleasing in His sight. And Solomon will tell us in Ecclesiastes 9:10, whatever your hands find to do, do it with all your might. Hard work, work hard. And Paul, writing to the Colossians in Colossians 3:23, when he tells them there about how their relationship as in Christ in regards to their employers, he says, whatever you do, you work heartily as for the Lord and not for men. We're supposed to work hard. And the Proverbs are full of admonishments. They admonish us to gain wisdom. They admonish us to gain insight. They admonish us to gain understanding. All of those components are needed to acquire skill in whatever it is that you may be doing. And we should work hard. We should be skillful in all that we do, whatever that may be. You understand, Solomon is not just talking about what you do from 9 to 5 or Monday through Friday. It's how you work in your home. It's how you take care of your home. It's how you take care of your yard. It's what you do wherever. It's just this desire to say, I'm going to be better than my neighbor in whatever it is that I'm doing. We've learned hard work and skill will allow me to do that. We should work hard. We should be skillful in all that we do. Because both hard work and skill are honorable traits before the Lord. And Solomon tells us here that sadly and too often, man's motivation behind his hard work, man's motivation behind being better at something so that he or she can outdo his or her neighbor, whether it be in fame, whether it be in possessions, whether it be in status, I just want to be better than them. And I've learned that if I'll just work a little harder, and if I'm just a little better, that will allow me to do it. We want what our neighbors have, as well as what they don't. We want to be superior to them. We use our hard work and our skill to achieve it. We see them as the avenue in which we can acquire what our envious hearts want. So what do? Well, if I'm going to acquire what they have or get better than what they have, then I'm just going to apply myself. And I'm going to work hard and I'm going to have more skill than they do. And rather than having joy in our God-given labors that He has given us to do on this earth, and rather than having joy in the skills that He has bestowed upon us, we use those very things that are a gift to us from Him, we use those things to fuel our own envy. And rather than seeing our work and our skill as means to glorify God, we use them to glorify ourselves. We use them to fuel the sinful passions of envy that wage war within us. So you have the root of envy. Being discontent, having displeasure, distrust in what God does and provides for us. It's the passions that wage war within us. We have these battles. We have this desire to want more. We've learned that hard work and skill, we can use those to glorify us rather than glorifying God. They fuel our envy by allowing us to acquire what our sinful passions long for. Number three, the emptiness of envy. The emptiness of envy. So we see what's at the root of envy. We see what allows us to feed that envy, to fuel that envy. But what does it really accomplish? So what if you get more than what your neighbor has? What if you are better than them at something? Right? We aren't happy with what we have, and so we envy what our neighbor has. We work hard and we become skillful so that we can have what our neighbors have with the desire to have more than what they have. What does that really accomplish? What does this back and forth between our fellow man amount to? And Solomon says, he tells us at the end of verse 4, this pursuit, this rivalry that goes on between mankind trying to outdo the other, he says, this also is vanity and a striving after wind. Solomon sees this rivalry that we have with our neighbor, this rivalry where we use our hard work, we use our skill to elevate ourselves over our neighbor. He says this is an endless and empty endeavor. It accomplishes nothing in the sight of God when it is all said and done. No matter what one acquires, and regardless of how much fame one can obtain, he's like, it will never satisfy the cravings of your envious heart. In fact, he says they do the complete opposite. They're just going to cause you to just want more. More fame, more possessions, more status, more pleasures, you name it. These sinful passions that wage war within us, that we fuel with hard work and skill, these sinful passions compel us to work harder and longer so that we can satisfy those envious and sinful desires. We do that often at the sacrifice of our service to God and to the church. These sinful passions that wage war within us, that compel us to never be satisfied with our work or our skill. Because if we ever get satisfied, if we're ever content with these things, as soon as we are, we're going to get passed by someone else. And we can't have that. And our envious heart won't allow it. And so we just keep going on, and we keep pursuing. Not only, Solomon tells us here that it's futile, it's an empty pursuit, like chasing the wind. You'll be weary, you'll be wore out, you'll never be satisfied. But not only is our envy of our neighbor an empty pursuit that never satisfies and that leaves us empty-handed and always grasping for more, more seriously, it is a sin against God. And the children of Israel were given the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. The final commandment given to them was this: you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. The longing for what belongs to another, the longing for what belongs to your neighbor, is a serious sin against God. You may ask, well, why is it such a sin against him? We're not really wanting something from him. We're wanting something from our neighbor. Why does it bother him so much? Because it implies that you don't trust him enough to provide for you. It implies that you don't trust him to provide you with what you actually need in this life. And it reveals that you're looking to material things to satisfy your heart instead of God. It is a grave sin. The psalmist says envying our neighbor is futile. It's meaningless because it never satisfies. It leaves us empty-handed, always grasping for more. And it is a serious sin against God. You see the emptiness. Why pursue such a thing when that's the results? So that leads us to our fourth point, and we'll spend a little time here. Is there any alternatives to envy? If it is all those things that we just mentioned, is there something that we can do besides envy our neighbor? Is there an alternative? Is there something better? And Solomon presents us here with two in verses 5 and 6. And he presents them to us in the form of imagery. That is, he uses these descriptions to help us better understand these alternatives to rivaling and envy with our neighbor. These alternatives to this, we've got to get one up on the next person. Before we look at each of these alternatives, I think it's important to mention that one of these alternatives that Solomon describes, and really there could be two depending on how you look at it, three alternatives total, two alternatives that are wrong. One of them that he does mention here is a wrong alternative to envy. He's not saying that we should do it. He's just saying this is what some people choose to do rather than envying their neighbor. Not all Christians are the ones that say, well, I'm not going to envy my neighbor. There are others that come to that conclusion as well. And he illustrates that for us here. So let's look at the first alternative to envy. Laziness. verse 5. He says here, "The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh." This is a wrong, but it's somewhat seemingly natural alternative to envy. Some might consider this rather than envy. "I'll just stop working. That'd be the way to go. I like that idea." The folding of hands describes someone who has chosen simply just to stop working and not do anything. I'm just going to rest. If hard work and skill really fuel envy, if that's what kind of motivates us to acquire more and allows us to acquire more than our neighbor, if that's what allows us to acquire what our envious hearts long for, then maybe if I don't want to get in that battle, that constant back and forth, because by the way, more than likely, it doesn't matter how hard I work, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm not going to be able to compete with them anyway. So the best thing for me to do is just to give up. I just won't work at all. I won't apply myself. As we see here, laziness is not a viable alternative to envy in any shape or form. In fact, the imagery that Solomon uses here describes something that is very bleak and very dangerous. He describes here the individual who gives himself over to laziness as a fool. And he's not beating around the bush there. He's very intentional. This man's out of his mind. He's crazy. He's full. He lacks wisdom. He refuses understanding. He's not just simply ignorant. He knows what he should be doing. He says, "I'm not going to do that." He is full in all forms of the word. He's a fool because he's refused to understand that his work is a gift to him from God. You can decide to stop working, but what you don't realize is you are supposed to work because that's a gift from God. And it says, "I'm not going to work." And so he's refused. He's turned his back upon the gift that God has given him. He realizes, we realize that what we do in this life, again, it's not, we use work and it's become such a vernacular in our world. Every time we think of work, we talk about what we do Monday through Friday. It isn't just that. It's anything that we do in life. Anything that we toil for. And rather than seeing our life as a means to serve God and bring him glory, the fool here just says, "I'm not going to do anything." That doesn't destroy the envy in his heart. Instead, Solomon says it destroys his own flesh. He says there at the end of verse 4, he eats his own flesh. Again, Solomon's imagery here is startling. It literally could be read that the man gnaws at his own knuckles. By refusing to work and apply himself, by refusing to take advantage of the gifts of God, to use those as a means to serve God and to bring God glory, the lazy man destroys himself. Now, some take that statement a little too literally and believe that Solomon is saying here that because the foolish person refuses to work, that he gets to the point where he has to eat his own flesh in order to be able to survive because he has nothing to eat, he has no resources. It's possible, but I don't think that really fits into the context of what Solomon is trying to communicate here. And I believe that what Solomon is communicating to us is this: the foolish man doesn't deal with the envy in his own heart that he has for his neighbor. He doesn't deal with that passion. He doesn't deal with that war that wages within him. Instead, he just simply refuses to work. "I'm not going to do anything." And that causes him to consume the resources that he has, and thus he's not able to compete with his neighbor any longer, because I don't have the resources to be able to do that. But the envious desires of the heart are still there. He's never dealt with those issues. He's just destroyed himself because he's allowed the wages of the heart that are still there just to continue to consume him. He just no longer now has the resources to be able to compete on an outward form. The envy is still there. In Proverbs chapter 24, verses 33 and 34 says this, along the same lines: "A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man." He didn't have anything to compete anymore. He can't compete with his neighbors. The neighbors don't look to him as someone that says, "I want to be like them," because he's now lazy and he no longer has the resources to be able to compete with them either. He neglects the gift of God. He consumes his resources. But yet he does not deal with the envy of his own heart. He remains a fool. So, alternative number one, laziness. As we see, it's not a viable alternative to envy. The second alternative that Solomon gives us here, contentment. Verse 6. "Better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after wind. Again, Solomon's imagery here in verse 6 is completely fascinating to me when you look at it. You have two hands, two full hands, cupped together, trying to gain everything they can. And you have one hand that is also full, but not with stuff or toil. Instead, it's full of quietness, peace, tranquility, joyous contentment. You always think about it, two is always better than one. And at first, when you look at this verse, it might appear that two hands would always be better than one, right? Who would want two? Who would want one when you can have two? He says these two full hands are costly. Because in order to have two full hands, you have to work. You have to work, and 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 you have to work. And yet, with all that work, he says, you're still left with nothing. Because you're striving after the wind. So he says, working more doesn't solve the problem of envy. Well, I'll just work harder, I'll just obtain more. That way, that will solve my envious desires of my heart. He says, that does not solve the problem of envy. It too, like laziness, is not a viable alternative. Right? Yes, for sure. With two hands full of toil, you can try to acquire as much as you can in this life. And with two hands, you can carry more of the weight of the world. A bigger home, more possessions, more wealth, more pleasures, a better life. You think, he says, the weight of the world is heavy. It weighs you down. It leaves you weary. It leaves you restless. It leaves you like you've been chasing the wind all of your life. Because even though your hands are full with everything that the world may have to offer, everything that would allow you to compete well with your neighbor, everything that satisfies the envious desires of your own heart, he says it's still like chasing after the wind. You just want more. It's what your envious heart wants, more. So he says better than both of these, right? Better than laziness, better than working more, is working with one hand. Because doing so, we can guard our work in one hand with contentment and peace in the other hand, and quietness. You see the beautiful imagery here. One handful of toil is better than none. Because as you saw in the case of the fool, if there's no hands of toil, you don't have the resources to compete. So one hand of toil is necessary, and it's better than none. But he says one hand of toil is also better than two. Because with two, you never have time to rest and enjoy your labors. So Solomon beautifully commends rest over toil. Yes, you need rest, he says. And he commends the rest over toil. But he separates rest from laziness. There's a difference. He's telling us that it is much better to have a few things with less toil and be satisfied with those things and to be at ease and to be at rest than to be consumed with work and the weight of the world's goods and with envy, all so that you can say, I'm better than that person. Proverbs 15:16. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. Proverbs 16:8, better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. Proverbs 17:1, better is a dry morsel with quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. Ecclesiastes 4:6, better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after the wind. Understand, contentment is not only a better alternative to envy, but contentment is the cure to putting the death of the sinful passions in your heart to death, to be content with what God has given, with what God provides. As we look at this passage this morning, Solomon has put before us another blaring red light. Warning, warning, warning. It flashes before us, and it warns us of the dangers of trying to find satisfaction and happiness in life apart from God. This time, the warning is in regards to the envy of our neighbors. He's saying to us, rather than toiling with envy, looking for satisfaction and happiness in life, in possessions and fame and wealth and status, we should toil with contentment. One hand, working for the glory of God, which is very rewarding, seeing our toil as a gift from Him. And the other hand, we use to rest, content with what God gives and being content with what God doesn't give. As we do that, we take to the heart the words of our Lord, who tells us in Luke 12:15, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Let's pray. Father, may we heed the words of our Lord this morning. May we take care. Those words themselves imply to us that the danger is very, very real. And we have to be aware of that. We have to be cautious of that. We have to be looking out for that. He tells us to be on guard against covetousness. It's deceitful. It hides itself behind hard work. It hides itself behind skill. It hides itself behind us thinking that we're just trying to make a better life for ourselves. It hides behind such things that in the eyes of the world it looks so plausible, looks so wise. But in many ways it just hides the deceitful desires of our heart, the passions that wage war within us. We're not happy with what God gives. We don't trust Him to provide. We don't rest. We'd rather work and work and work and work and work and toil and toil and toil rather than rest in what you provide. We all do it because we are led to believe that that's the better life. That's the good life. And while it may bring temporal blessings on this earth, it's just that, temporal. They don't satisfy, nor do they last. And as soon as they're gone, we are racing after another. So Lord, help us to wage that war within our heart, to ask for our provisions, to ask what we need in this life, not to use it on our own passions, but as James tells us, may we use those to glorify you with our life, resting, one hand full of quietness, one hand serving you with all of our life. May you, Lord, grant us the grace and the wisdom to evaluate our own hearts, to be on guard, to take care, and to live our life for Christ. We pray these things in His name. Amen.